all that matters is. Wrong!
This town deserves a better class.
Heavy Metal Podcast.
I'm gonna get a.
If you do not listen, then the hell with you.
Walk through the gate of consciousness. Stop, love, drop from under you.
Hello, and welcome back to So Far So Pod So What? A transatlantic heavy metal podcast. This is Jonathan, but you can call me Johnny Hot Dog, like I make the rest of my family. I am here with my co-host Greg. Say hello, Greg.
Thrash.
Okay, good morning, Greg. We're doing something a little bit different today. We have decided to hand the podcast over to one of our best friends and the godfather to our children, Queen from And Volume for All. Actually, it was Greg's idea. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you thought we should give our show to Queen?
You know Campbell Corpse is from Buffalo?
Yeah. No, I read that on your Twitter feed. Yeah.
Sabres.
Yeah, Sabres too. Yeah, but that's not a band. That's a hockey team, Greg.
Hockey. Thrash.
You know, that's a great segue, Greg. So let me introduce the man who needs no introduction, if you have already met him, Queen. Hello, Queen.
Hey, guys. Hey, thank you. Thank you so much for letting me hijack your show here.
Sure. Looking forward to it, yes.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it because I wanted to cover Megadeth more when I talked about Thrash, but Metallica kind of sucked all the air out of the episode.
Well, now you know how Dave Mustaine feels,
right? Dimebag. I'm sorry, Greg, what's that?
Oh, Greg just says dimebag to himself from time to time. I edit most of them out.
All right, well, okay. Thanks, guys. If you don't mind, I'll just take Megadeth for a spin around the block here, but I promise to have her back in one piece.
Why do you say that?
A piece? Peace. It was a Megadeth joke. Just peace sells, rust in peace. Yeah.
Must be a translation thing because I don't get it, and you know Swedes are known for our sense of humor.
Oh God, you were being serious. Like Megadeth's a car. Yep, like Megadeth was a car. That was the joke, Greg. All right. Well, I'm just gonna lock you in this closet here so that I can start, but I will bring you back out at the end.
Can we have some snacks? Some lutefisk or something?
Okay. All right, guys. Bye. Have fun. We're finally alone.
Let's start this thing.
Hey girl, are you looking for a little romance? Well, you came to just the right place because I have two very sexy words for you. Gas and station.
No, you don't include the and. Yes, that would make it three words, but no, I was trying to surprise you because gas station is a familiar phrase, but if I break it up with the and, it creates a little mental dissonance, like a riddle, a very sexy riddle. You're not into it? Gas station sex doesn't do it for you? What are you, Amish? All right, I'll just start the show by myself then. Welcome to And Volume So What? I usually have only one ellipse in my show title, but because Greg and Jonathan have been so kind as to let me ruin guest host their show, I got ellipses coming out my ass, and that little intestinal distress is just what happens when you decide to cover Megadeth. So today, and 2 or 3 weeks from now, and likely 2 or 3 weeks from then, I am going to be doing an old-school AV4A deep dive on Megadeth and its founder and frontman, the Roger Moore of heavy metal, David Scott Mustaine. Now, I would love to cover Megadeth and just Megadeth, but as I think every metalhead knows, there is an elephant in seemingly every room Dave Mustaine walks into, and that particular master of pachyderms is Metallica. As listeners of this show know, I love Metallica's first four albums and nothing after that. My relationship with Megadeth has always been more of an appreciation as a metal connoisseur. I like Megadeth, like, a lot. I owned Rust in Peace and Countdown to Extinction as a young derelict, but they were never my band the way that Metallica or Black Sabbath were. And it wasn't until I was much older that I even knew that there was a decade-spanning and frequently rancorous debate surrounding the question that I believe was originally proposed by Heraclitus of Ephesus, Megadeth versus Metallica, who's better? Yeah, I never really had to or wanted to take a side on that argument, unlike Xenophanes of Colophon, who really stepped in it with his Anthrax is better than both treatise. I don't think he ever got laid again after that, and Grecian boys of the late 6th century weren't exactly picky. I said in an earlier podcast that the way I look at it, they're both great and they both suck, depending on the album and the issue being discussed. And I agree with me from a few months ago, but telling the story of Megadeth without talking about Metallica is like explaining the plot of Batman versus Superman without mentioning Batman. And explaining the plot of Batman versus Superman is hard enough as is. So, in order to tell the story of Metallica, I'm going to take a page out of a very old book by a guy named, any guesses? That's right, Plutarch. I know, you see it's a Megadeth episode, and like everybody else in the world, you think, please don't go into Lucius Metrius Plutarchus. We all know about the Middle Platonist philosopher, best known for pairing 23 well-known Greek and Roman figures into concurrent biographical narratives as a way of exploring their moral triumphs and failures through an antithetical historical and poetic analysis. Well, I'm sorry, but no one's ever come up with another way to talk about Megadeth. More commonly known as parallel lives, Plutarch's lives of the noble Greeks and Romans compared and contrasted great figures of history with one another so as to better understand both. Notable examples being Theseus and Romulus, Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, and of course, Mark Antony and J-Lo. Rather than trotting out more tired, nostalgia-centric biographies like Bohemian Rhapsody or, Conan, Plutarch thought that he and both of his readers could learn more about Freddie Mercury and the Sumerian conqueror of the Hyborian Age by imagining them together. And I bet Freddie Mercury would have liked that very much. By considering these two heroes of ancient time in a parallel narrative, Plutarch felt that he could more convincingly articulate the merits and deficiencies of their respective characters, illuminating the true nature of one with reflected light from the other. Plus, Conan the Queen is a great title for a buddy cop movie about two guys who solve a murder by going undercover at a drag club. Like Metallica and Megadeth, well, I really should have workshopped that transition. Metallica and Megadeth, these two entities, one born out of the other, released debut albums within 2 years of one another. Shortly after that, they became 50% of what is known as the Big Four of thrash metal, alongside Anthrax and Slayer. And at the end of the decade, they each received their first Grammy nominations, again, within 2 years of one another. They both attempted to navigate the musical and cultural transitions into the early 90s and achieve their biggest commercial successes in that same decade, less than a year apart. In more recent decades, both Metallica and Megadeth have had to grapple with their mutual and exclusive histories. The loss of band members, the addition of new ones, the celebration of their 40th anniversaries, and the strange new reality of asking the guy at the concession stand at the stadium your thrash band just sold out if there's a senior discount. Like Plutarch, I think we can better understand Megadeth by the reflected light of Metallica. Because if there is a singular driving motivation that we can ascribe to Dave Mustaine, at least early on, it's revenge. And like all central characters in any historical drama, what makes Mustaine great is also what threatens to destroy him. But unlike Metallica, I'm not sure that we know the end of the Megadeth story yet. As we move through this story of vengeance, betrayal, ascendance to greatness, and decline into something else, maybe we'll discover that this story doesn't end the way we think it does. We begin our epic journey through the mega discography in a place that, had Dave Mustaine been a different kind of man, might very well have been the end of the tale. The womb from which all things mighty and glorious in this world eventually emerge. The back of a Greyhound bus.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping.
I don't know who those chicks are, but that is a great cover of that Disturbed song. On April 11th, 1983, Dave Mustaine sat, alone, on what must have felt like the slowest moving object to ever travel through space-time. That object would eventually return him to San Francisco and had set out that morning from a gray and drizzly Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo!
Thank you, Greg. With temperatures hovering around the mid to high 40s because I chose to Google that information rather than raising my children. That morning, Mustaine woke up, not dead, but with the kind of hangover that makes you wish you were, and a no-expenses-paid trip back to the West Coast, courtesy of his now former bandmates. The firing came as something of a surprise to Mustaine, who famously claimed in Metallica's 2001 documentary Some Kind of Bullshit that he was given no warning, no second chance, which, as lampooned as that moment has become, in metal culture, isn't really a bad point. Unless you're Dave Mustaine, who was currently on at least his fourth or fifth chance, having received multiple previous warnings. You see, Mustaine, in addition to being the lead guitarist for Metallica at the time, was also something of a drug dealer with something of a security problem. The security problem of note being that he didn't have any. So while he was rifling through Metallica's set on stage, people would come backstage and rifle through his. And like any for-profit entity dealing with a loss prevention issue, Dave innovated his way toward a solution once he got it approved by his board chair and stockholders, and bought some big fucking dogs to guard his shit. One evening in the summer of 1982, while chatting with his bandmates, presumably over Keynesian strategies to deal with the fluctuations in spending components and their effect on a company's fiscal output, one of those big fucking dogs scratched Metallica's then-bassist Ron McGovney's car. Lead singer James Hetfield, a fierce advocate for public oversight due to a staunch belief that private sector decisions can often lead to adverse macroeconomic outcomes, kicked Mustaine's big fucking dog in the chest to keep it away from Ron's car. This led to an altercation between Hetfield and Mustaine in which the future Megadeth frontman, while advocating for Adam Smith's invisible hand of the free market, simultaneously employed his own very visible hand to punch Hetfield in the face. Mustaine was fired that evening, but rejoined the band the next day after what was, by all accounts, a contrite apology and an admission that a robust regulatory apparatus is necessary to disincentivize the more negligent or predatory excesses of private enterprise. But while in theory Mustaine was no longer openly hostile to market stabilization, in practice, he stole all of Ron McGovney's shit, causing Metallica's almost bassist to leave the band. It was at this point Lars Ulrich and James Hetfield started listening to other lead guitarists, looking for someone who could replace Mustaine. And that's just about the time that during his shift driving Metallica's van on a cross-country trip to tour the Northeast, first Mustaine and then the van got smashed in Laramie, Wyoming, nearly killing everyone on board. In an interview with Gibson's Icon series, Mustaine said, "Because of the crash in Laramie, Wyoming, that's what made me the guy that had to go." So, if we're keeping score here, at this point in his tenure with Metallica, Dave Mustaine had punched out the lead singer, robbed the bassist, and nearly killed them all in a car accident that resulted from his uncontrollable downward spiral into addiction. No warning? No second chance? The van incident would presage a further pattern for Mustaine in which he would use copious amounts of drugs and alcohol to get him through some of the worst places in life. Like Wyoming. And to be fair, if I have to travel through Wyoming, there are really only two ways that I would want to do that. One is drunk, and the other is dead. And if you choose drunk, you still gotta wake up hungover in Nebraska. So. Worse yet, Mustaine would have to reverse traverse all the flyover states by driving through them, or rather riding through them, on the Greyhound bus of consequences where he would soon discover there ain't, in fact, no going back. But for him, we're actually back where we started, so clearly there's some turning back for us, and I therefore assume we'll never face consequences. Needless to say, Dave Mustaine had a lot to think about on that bus ride home and roughly 2,650 miles or 4,264 kilometers in which to do it. He said in the Gibson series, "I did a lot of soul searching on the way home. Did I want to play guitar? Did I want to keep doing this? What am I going to do?" With the benefit of hindsight, it's easy for us to say, "Of course! You're Dave fucking Mustaine! One of the most important figures in heavy metal history. Go forth and Megadeth, young man. But unlike me, Mustaine is no dummy. He must have known the odds were not in his favor here. I'm not a musician, nor am I part of the music industry, but I know enough to know that it fucking sucks. It's a brutal, unforgiving, cutthroat pile of pirates and sociopaths fighting over a much smaller pile of money and attention. Mustaine was essentially cast out to sea by his only friends and had nothing to show for his time and effort beyond a terrible reputation and two big fucking dogs. Any kind of redemptive storyline emerging from this, the saddest bus ride in the history of fucking time, was less than improbable. Mustaine's ascendancy to metal godhood may seem inevitable now, but if such a feat were so easily achieved, why didn't Ron McGovney do it? Why don't we have a similar story about Pete Best or Tony Chapman starting up new bands to rival the Beatles or the Stones? You know, in 1989, a guy named Jason Everman left Nirvana right before they released Bleach to go on tour with Soundgarden supporting Louder Than Love, where he was eventually replaced before the band released the album Bad Motorfinger. This guy was in two of the biggest bands in the world in the early 90s, and if anybody had the resume to start their own band, it would be Jason Everman. Instead, he got shit out of the bottom of the music industry in the mid-90s, joined the military, and then studied art at Columbia University, where we can only assume he had a falling out with Ferry Shepard and Banksy at the precise moment in time before they achieved international recognition and acclaim. Jason Everman's like bizarro Forrest Gump. At each and every pivotal moment in history, he was there. Just before it started, because he had to go clean out his garage right then. One of music history's most tragic figures, Jason Everman. Super clean garage, though. Anyway, back to the Mustainical Mystery Tour. We don't know exactly how Megadeth's future frontman arrived at his final mega destination, other than by bus, but we do know that he did arrive, both in San Francisco and at a conclusion. Despite the swirling morass of doubts and fears that accompanied him on that fateful trip, at one point, a light bulb went off over Mustaine's head. And once the bus driver replaced that, Dave got an idea. I don't know why I'm here. And frankly, I'd like me to leave. He described the moment to Gibson like this. I got it. I'm gonna make a band that's more metal than Metallica, and I need to come up with a name that's more metal than a band that has metal in their name. So what can I come up with? Okay, first off, I want you to know that I am pulling a Lemmy again. I did that fucking thing where I had no intention of doing a Dave Mustaine impression, and all of a sudden I start to read his quotes and I'm like, now I'm gonna talk like Dave Mustaine, or like I think I remember him talking on all the interviews that I've watched lately. I don't know. I fucking don't know if he sounds like that. I just started doing it because I want to be shot out of a cannon and into a wall. I hate myself for loving you. That whole, more metal than a band with metal in the name is the God damn it, why am I doing this fucking accent? This accent, this fucking voice. Unconscionable. Second of all, Dave, you kind of sound like you're starting to steal my shit. That whole, more metal than a band with metal in the name is the kind of absurdity that I peddle like a stereotypical Middle Eastern street merchant in a standalone episode of the 80s television show MacGyver, in which he accidentally discovers the Holy Grail and, in order to escape a local prison, uses two paper clips and a roll of duct tape to transform the Sangreal of Arthurian legend into a single-engine plane, upon which is written a message to his captors reading, "The power of Christ propels me." Don't try to out-stupid me, Dave. Stupid is my business. And business is good. Anyway, according to Kerrang, the heavy metal magazine that got its name as a result of dropping a tin can down the stairs, Mustaine was scribbling lyrics on the back of a flyer that read, "The arsenal of Megadeth can't be rid no matter what the peace treaties come to." I'm just guessing it wasn't a flyer for grammar lessons. The term of interest here is Megadeth, which first appeared in 1953 as a way of saying nuclear war just had its 1 millionth customer. But instead of confetti and balloons, you get third-degree burns and radiation poisoning. But Mustaine soon learned that there was a proto-hardcore punk-slash-death-metal band that had already called themselves the Megadeths before changing their name to Pink Floyd. And they sound fucking brutal. So he dropped the A and went with the more incorrect spelling of death as D-E-T-H. Having chosen this particular nuclear deplume, it's pretty clear what was on his mind. Metallica had seemingly discarded Mustaine into the void of music history, and he did not want to go quietly into that long, cold night. He wanted something more than a footnote on Metallica's Wikipedia page. Dave Mustaine wanted revenge.
This is Chief Deputy Carl Thornton at SFSP Towers. Urgent call for John and Greg at HQ. The SFSP Towers are suffering a breach attempt. I repeat, attempted intrusion at the SFSP Towers. Culprit currently identified as Brian Mace and Queen for All.
Oh, looks like I'm having a little technical difficulty here. Somebody's trying to hack into the old mainframe, which is a real thing. So if you hear a couple of voices and they sound kind of like Jonathan and Greg, you know, telling you, oh, don't trust Quinn. We didn't ask him to do our podcast. He emailed us some malware that allowed him to hijack our production equipment and post pictures of us at a One Direction concert we had hidden in a file labeled Mortgage Info 2019 on Greg's desktop.
Probably no big deal, right?
No big deal? It's easy for you to say, dude. You're the fucking cool sounding one.
Don't listen to them. None of that's true. It was labeled Mortgage Info 2018, so inconsistency there. Anyway, I think now's a good time to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about Mustaine's life up to this point, the band he cobbled together, the drugs he didn't do, because that's just a shorter list, and how in 1985 he would finally unfurl the vengeance he had planned against his former friends, bandmates, and brothers in Metallica. Vengeance that sounded like this when we come back.
Something's not right. Something's coming over us. What the fuck is this?
Carl, where are you? We need you. Carl.
Regrettably so, I am announcing my departure from position of Chief Deputy of Digital Security at this establishment. At this point, my one suggestion is to get legal involved and propose an agreement with Mr. Quintessential.
This is fucking bullshit, all right? I do not, repeat, do not sound like that. Quinn is fucking toying with getting an ass kicking, dude.
I'm kind of feeling this Romanian vampire character, though.
Not great, not terrible.
I can dig.
Dave Mustaine was born in La Mesa, or The Table, California, in 1961. Like James Hetfield, Mustaine's family was deeply religious in one of the worst religions in which one can choose to go deep. While Mustaine's parents were Christian Scientists who believed that all illness can be healed by just, you know, thinking about it, Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the only kind of healing needed in this corrupt human society controlled by Satan and his demons is a cool, cleansing Armageddon. Despite their ideological differences, Christian scientists and Jehovah's Witnesses both require strict adherence to such doctrines as dying of curable diseases, in the case of the former, and showing up at strangers' homes unannounced, of the latter. Both religions emerged in the late 19th century as restorationist philosophies dedicated to the idea that modern Christianity had lost its way and needed to return to the original principles of the faith, namely, creeping people out and just being generally fucking weird. Check and check. Before the age of four, Mustaine's father lost his job as a branch manager at the Bank of America, sending him spiraling into alcoholism and adding insult to inebriation. Mustaine's mother divorced his father in 1965. But, being a deeply devout Jehovah's Witness, Mustaine's father did what any man of great faith would do and deserted his family forever, leaving Mustaine to be raised by his mother and three wicked stepsisters. And despite local fauna banding together in a magical act of weaving him a new dress to wear to the prince's ball, Mustaine opted to become a heavy metal musician instead, and one with something of a distaste for religion. Meanwhile, back in 1983, Mustaine is fired by Metallica, who, considering the age difference between himself and his sisters, who he frequently referred to as his aunts, must have felt like the only brothers Mustaine ever had. And like a petulant sibling, once again betrayed by his own family, Mustaine warns them, "Don't touch my stuff," and forbids them from using the material he created during his tenure as the band's lead guitarist. Metallica, of course, ever sensitive to the wishes of their former collaborator, ignores his warning entirely and 3 months after firing him uses four of his songs on the debut album titled Kill 'Em All, which we talked about in episode 3 part 1 of this podcast. One of those tunes becomes the centerpiece of the record, with new lyrics and a Lynyrd Skynyrd-inspired bridge by the title of The Four Horsemen. But it was originally a Dave Mustaine joint about Dave Mustaine's joint. And the aforementioned gas station of carnal knowledge, titled Mechanics, with an X, like sex. Okay, at this point, Mustaine needs a band. And this is where destiny, as he calls it, starts to work for him instead of against him. First, he moved into an apartment at 1736 North Sycamore Avenue in Hollywood. The address isn't important. I don't know why I included it. Don't commit that to memory. Directly above the apartment of one of the greatest heavy metal bassists of all time, David Ellefson. Now, Mustaine didn't know that Ellefson was one of the greatest heavy metal bassists of all time, and for that matter, neither did Ellefson. But these two Daves made up the backbone of the foreign life form that would emerge from the ashes of Hangar 18 and Mustaine's career to become the single greatest rival to Metallica's heavy metal monopoly throughout the late 80s and early 90s. The other bit of good fortune for Mustaine upon meeting Dave Ellefson was that Zoom didn't exist yet. More on that much later. The remainder of the band came together in the form of Chris Poland or Poland? Poland or Poland? I don't know, because I don't talk to people. The remainder of the band came together in the form of Chris Poland on guitar. I can't imagine it would be too fun to be the other guitarist in a band with Dave Mustaine, but I'm sure it'll end well. Poland said of his hiring, "Gar told me they were looking for another guitarist and said I should go down to Mars Studio and rent a room, set up my stuff, and play really loud. So I did, and Dave walked in and asked me to join the band. He was drunk." Wow, okay, so it didn't even start well. Contrary to my imagination, the Gar of Poland's quote was not a lasagna-loving cartoon cat. It's the future drummer of Megadeth, Gar Samuelson, who is a bit different from the others. You might say that he marches to the sound of his own instrument. I wish someone had written a metaphor that I could use here, but it just doesn't exist. Trust me, I'm a writer. If there was one, I'd know about it. Mustaine told Metal Hammer in 2020, "I didn't like Gar at first because he didn't look metal, but when he started playing, I was like, wow, this really highlights the intricacies of my riffs and my picking style." Sort of a quintessentially Mustainian quote there, except for the, you know, impression. "I didn't like him, but then I found out he made me look really good." Yeah, there you go. That's Mustaine. As Poland described it, Dave hit the jackpot when he met Gar. He had swing, he was a huge Who and Zeppelin fan, which I will not hold against him, but he was a jazz guy. No one else in that scene listened to jazz drummers. He brought an element to that music that no one else has brought to metal to this day. Something of a side note, at this point, Chris Poland and Gar Samuelson were very serious heroin addicts, and it didn't take long before Mustaine and Ellefson joined them in that endeavor, in addition to coke, weed, and of course the demon alcohol. So you might think that this was four guys who played drugs and did some music on the side, but they were serious enough and good enough that a guy named Jay Jones, a Hollywood music industry regular in the hardcore punk and hip-hop scenes, signed on to manage them. Finally, Mustaine and his band had the legitimacy that they were looking for. Oh, nope, he was a drug dealer. Jay Jones. Okay. And Mustaine fired him as executive producer halfway through the recording of their first record. All right, well, you know, J'ai la vie. In 2022, Mustaine gave some background on that decision to Metal Hammer, saying, "I got to studio one day and Jay told me the others had spent $4,000 on coke, heroin, and hamburgers. And I was like, are you out of your fucking mind? You think that's bad? You ever listen to Volume 4? While $4,000 doesn't sound like a lot by today's standards, the entire budget for the album was $8,000. And while I'm no mathematician, I think $4,000 is almost half of that. Jay Jones' story was rounded out in Mustaine's heavy metal memoir titled Mustaine, A Heavy Metal Memoir, wherein he said, "Some years later, after he and Megadeth parted company, Jay Jones was stabbed to death with a butter knife during, rumor has it, a fight over a bologna sandwich. That's not funny, of course, but if you know Jay, neither is it particularly surprising." Well, I think Mustaine is wrong here, and that's a pretty stupid thing to say, because that story is very funny. Now, if it's a BLT or a turkey club, yeah, I could understand feeling torn. But a bologna sandwich? I mean, come on. I am just one man. Regardless of the mega debauchery going on behind the scenes, the band signed a deal in early 1985 for their first album with the aptly titled Combat Records. So, Dave Mustaine has a band. He has a record contract. He's got a handful of killer tracks with something to say and all the hard drugs and rage issues he needs to pull this thing off. All this record needs now is a name. On July 20th of 1985, Megadeth released their debut record. If you remember episode 3, part 1 of And Volume for All, or me talking earlier on this one, in 1983, 2 years before, Metallica's debut threatened to kill them all. So it's hard to read the title of Megadeth's debut as anything other than a rejoinder to Mustaine's former band. As if Megadeth's frontman was saying, "Oh, you think you're gonna kill them all? Killing is your pastime. You kill on evenings, weekends, and Fridays that fall on the day after a holiday. You kill like a junior varsity girls volleyball team, and you bought your hit kit at Joanne Fabrics just to show off your sewing circle. Kill them all? Killing is your hobby. I am become Megadeth. Killing is my business, and business is good." Am I editorializing here a bit? Yeah. Have you heard the pod? But if we take Mustaine at his word when he talks about Metallica, that he was out for blood, theirs, then naming Megadeth's debut Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good is a Costco-sized fuck you to Lars, James, Kirk, and Cliff. Let me just do a quick word count here. Metallica has recorded 11 studio albums. If you add up all the words in the titles of those albums, there are 26. The word kill, or any form of it, is used exactly once as the first word in the title of their first album. Megadeth has recorded 16 studio albums for a total of 52 words, because you know Mustaine was like, I'm gonna prove to Metallica I can write longer song titles than them. Yeah, you got a title that's a full sentence? Mine's two full sentences, and with an ellipse in between. Of those 52 words comprising Megadeth titles, killing, the present participle of kill, is, just like Metallica, used exactly once. And also like Metallica, it's the first word in the title of their first album. If that doesn't convince you that Dave Mustaine was going after his former band with this album, perhaps the opening moments of Kill 'Em All contrasted with the opening moments of Killing Is My Business will. I only wish someone loved you guys enough to put those two sounds together when they were supposed to be working.
Ah, come on. You know I did it for ya. Who loves you, you beautiful mother punchers? Oh.
Take a listen. That is Hit the Lights by Metallica, followed by Last Rites, Loved to Death, spelled D-E-T-H, by Megadeth. Mustaine describes Last Rites as boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, girl doesn't love boy, boy kills girl so no one else will have her. Well, did you show her the gas station? Because you could have closed the deal right there, my friend. He continues by saying it was written about Diana Aragon, a lovely creature that I thought I would never be able to be with, and I wrote my version of a love song about her. But if we go back to Mustaine's seemingly deliberate use of the word kill for this album and apply it to this opening track, the lyrics take on something of a double meaning. If I can't have you, then no one will. And since I won't, I'll have to kill. And so he does, sending her, since this is a song about a woman and not four men, sending her to heaven, but him to hell. But, surprise, for some reason, she went down to hell with him.
I wonder what she did to warrant that. Would she fire you from her band or something?
The lyrics continue, and now you're coming back. Baby, take me, please. I really think I would if you weren't such a sleaze. I just wonder where Mustaine keeps the Poet Laureate statue he won for these lyrics. I've never seen it in an interview or anything. I loved you once before you kept me on a string. I'd rather go without than take what you would bring, Lars. Wait, why did I say Lars? I meant James. Diana Aragon, who this song is definitely about. Following Last Rites is the title track, Killing Is My Business, and Business Is Good, in which Mustaine writes, I am a sniper, always hit the mark, paid assassin, working after dark, and I know just what to do, and you know I'll do it too, then I'm coming back for you, back for you. Now pay me quickly, and now we're through. It brings me great pleasure to say my next job is you. Don't you know that killing is my business, and business is good. According to Pop Matters, the song was inspired by a Punisher comic. Mustaine told Metal Hammer,
I thought it was cool that it had this twist whereby you paid someone to kill somebody and they came back and go, by the way, somebody's paid me to kill you.
Well, that is cool, Dave, but throwing whereby into the plot description like it's a Tolstoy novel doesn't make it any less of a song you wrote about a comic book. Of course it's about the Punisher. Who else would it be about? It's not like at the time someone or some ones were paying Mustaine for work that he had done while he was also fantasizing about exacting vengeance on those same guys, right? I can't think of a popular 80s band during that time about whom that would be true. Maybe Foreigner. All right, not all of these songs are about Metallica. There is some Megadeth lore that gets laid out in the old blueprints of Killing Is My Business. On the song Rattlehead, Megadeth took a page out of Iron Maiden's very long, very nerdy sci-fi fantasy book series titled Time Knights of Sickness 4082 and gave themselves a mascot.
Oh, here I come!
Rattlehead Vic, a skull-headed victim of censorship, which is what the Vic stands for. He is prevented from speaking, hearing, or seeing by metal plates bolted over his eyes, ears, and mouth. And while this seems at first to be a detriment, it does give him quite an advantage should he ever choose to pursue a career as a referee for the NBA. Zing! Take that, Kevin Cutler. I have no fucking idea. Mustaine came up with the idea from a see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil monkey statue that his grandmother once owned. Side note, my grandmother had a toothpick holder depicting the same image, which I now own, and which also failed to prevent any member of my rabidly atheistic family from promoting evil. In fact, it's how we all bond. It's on the crest. Rattlehead was also the term Mustaine's mother, Emily, used to describe his metalhead friends and the act of headbanging. Unfortunately, that particular coinage failed to catch on in the broader metal culture, as did Emily Mustaine's insistence on making fetch happen. Ugh, it's just all gonna end with me doing this for no one at all in some sort of mystical prison made out of mirrors, isn't it? Yeah, that's what I thought. The song I played earlier in reference to Mustaine's complicated relationship to Christianity is Looking Down the Cross, wherein Dave imagines the inner monologue of Jesus Christ beneath his more well-known sentiment, Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. Mustaine's gritty Bible reboot contrastingly features a son of God in a somewhat less forgiving mood, like when he says this, And now you too. This will come a putrefying pestilence, more noxious than the serpent's breath malevolently destined. More corrupt than the malice of Coronzon, more disease than the wind of the moonlight sun, Lars. God damn it, why do I keep saying Lars? Oh, sorry, I kind of broke character at the end there. Let me go back to being Jesus here. Dad damn it, why do I keep saying Larseth? And rounding out the B-side is the aforementioned Mechanics, the call me maybe of gas station attendants the world round, which Mustaine said he put on the album to straighten up Metallica, but just to mega drive his point home, Dave ended with a Motorhead-inspired cover of a song popularized by Nancy Sinatra. These boots were made for walkin'. Here's some of the lyrics of the one song that Dave Mustaine chose to cover on Killing Is My Business. These boots were made for walkin', as read by Christopher Walken. You keep lying when you ought to be truthin'. You keep losing when you ought not bet. You keep saying you ought to be changing. Now, what's right is right, but you ain't even right yet. These boots, they're made for walking. That's just what they'll do. And one of these days, these boots, they're gonna walk all over you. I had this uncomfortable hunk of Metallica up my ass for 2 years. Wait, no, sorry, that's Pulp Fiction, but instead of metal, I said Metallica. Why'd I say Metallica? That's really weird. All right, so if you haven't picked up on the subtle message I've been trying to hammer into your face now for about an hour, I think Killing Is My Business may have had something to do with the way Dave Mustaine felt about Metallica. And you know what? It fucking worked. Mustaine was on the Bruce Wayne retirement plan, where the guys you used to work with sabotage your entire life and leave you crippled at the bottom of an Eastern European prison camp most closely resembling a pit designed by M.C. Escher, who always had the freshest rhymes. Instead, Mustaine used the anger and resentment that came as a result of that experience to will himself back to fighting strength, climbing out of the pit without the use of the rope, because that's the way he went into the pit, as symbolized by the well into which he descended as a child upon his first encounter with the Batcave. It's through this rising action that Dave Mustaine rediscovers his own fear of death, the original impetus for his vigilante persona, and returns to redeem himself by saving Gotham City, which simultaneously fulfills the dualistic prophecy of Harvey Dent, who lived long enough to see himself become the villain, and Bruce Wayne's alter ego, who in the eyes of Gotham citizenry, died a hero. As well as the overarching thematic structure of the trilogy, which posits that death was the beginning of the Batman and the end of Bruce Wayne, and therefore the Batman had to die in order for Bruce Wayne to return to life. And that's the story of Megadeth. Without Metallica, there would be no Megadeth. The improbability of a comeback for Dave Mustaine in 1983 was roughly that of the Houston Texans ever winning a Super Bowl. Sorry to any Texans fans out there, not for what I just said, just in general. When Mustaine was fired from Metallica, what he lost was a band. But what he found was a purpose. And just to be clear, I said purpose. To my knowledge, Mustaine has never owned a Dolphin. And without that purpose, I don't think Killing Is My Business would have been the debut album that it was. And it was. Not only was the debut one of Combat Records' highest-selling releases, earning the band a chance to make a follow-up record, it catapulted Mustaine and Company past any derisive characterization as a Metallica spinoff and established Megadeth as a legit fucking metal band in their own right. And in retrospect, it's hard to see Killing Is My Business as anything other than one of the first albums to not just push thrash metal into the mainstream, but to push thrash metal to a place and to a pace that no one else had ever taken it, including Metallica. And again, I'm sorry to do this because I know how tired everyone in metal culture is of commentators analyzing Megadeth through the lens of the Plutarchian binary matrix, but show me another way. Doesn't exist. As I said before, all great figures of historical drama are threatened with destruction by the overindulgence of the very thing that makes them great. In the case of Dave Mustaine and Killing Is My Business, that thing is retribution. Before this series, I never considered any album that Megadeth made as comparable to the first four Metallica records. But with the advantage of going back and giving the early Megadeth material a number of truly proper listens, I don't think Killing Is My Business is as good as Kill 'Em All. I think it's better. Almost. Okay, we get it. You're angry. God, acting like Slayer fans. Where I think Megadeth's debut really succeeds are in those places that Mustaine is letting all the rage and resentment and hunger for vengeance fuel this music. I've been saying throughout the episode, Last Rites, Love You to Death, the title track, Rattlehead, Looking Down the Cross, they all feel like a consequence of that purpose. Purpose! I said purpose. You're mad about that now too? God. Why would a dolphin be on a bus anyway? It almost makes no sense. When he's possessed with that overriding super objective to make a metal band more metal than Metallica, Dave Mustaine does exactly that. I love Kill 'Em All. And when you put the best material on that album against the best material on Killing Is My Business, I have to admit, even as a lifelong Metallica pre-1991 stan, I'm torn. But when that possession starts to turn into obsession, I think Mustaine becomes his own worst enemy and compromises what could have been an unequivocal masterpiece. So where exactly, in my oh-so-dumble opinion, does Mustaine get out over his skis on the record? Evidence A. Mustaine admits to putting mechanics on the album to let the world know that the Four Horsemen was his song. And then he played it faster and used the original lyrics, which, to me, have the effect of making the entire endeavor feel unbalanced, in addition to violating one of those fundamental pillars of heavy metal that I made up in episode one. Namely, that the inclusion of mechanics makes the album feel suddenly and incongruently small. Metallica took a song about a fucking gas station, in both senses of that phrase, from Dave Mustaine and gave it a lyrical and thematic scale that matched its sound. Little compare and contrast here. Listen to the lyrics of Mechanics' chorus versus the chorus of the Four Horsemen. First up, here's Mechanics. Whoever thought you'd be better at turning a screw than me? I do it for my life. Made my drive shaft crank, made my pistons bulge, made my ball bearings melt from the heat. Oh yeah, yeah. And now here's the Four Horsemen. The horsemen are drawing nearer. On leather steeds they ride. They've come to take your life. On through the dead of night. With the Four Horsemen ride, or choose your fate and die. And, of course, the inimitable and inevitable, oh yeah, yeah. The Four Horsemen is fucking metal. Mechanics is just metal about fucking. And if you don't agree with me that its lyrical content undercuts the larger vision of Megadeth and the genre of heavy metal itself, listen to your friend Dave Elveson. He's a cool guy. And in a 1987 interview with Much Music, he said, "People don't listen to the lyrics of a lot of rock bands because they don't write anything that people want to listen to. They write about rock stars getting laid and how big the sock is in their pants. The lyrics in this band, we live in this world where you get hip quick or you get ripped off and raked over the coals. That's our saying. What are you new? Get a clue. Get hip to what's going on, and that's what I think Dave's lyrics are about. They're real street level, and it's, you know?" I actually bought a Megadeth shirt from that tour when I was 7, and that saying was all over their merch. It was a picture of Vic on the front with the words, "What are you new? Get a clue. Get hip to what's going on," and that's, and then you flip it over, and then on the back it says, "What I think Dave's lyrics are about. They're real street level." And then right above the butt, it says, "And it's, you know?" Love that shirt. And remember that James and Lars asked Mustaine to slow the song down with a bridge to give it scope and scale, the breath you need as a listener to appreciate it when you come back to that pummeling riff that Metallica played like this. Mustaine, by contrast, jettisoned the bridge entirely and chose instead to play that pummeling riff even faster, like this. Like I said in episode 3, part 1, Mustaine invented it, Metallica perfected it, and then Dave used it to go for the kill shot. And missed. Because he wanted it too much, and he was willing to sacrifice everything to get it. And perhaps Megadeth's frontman would have done well to heed the words of his former mentor and leader of the League of Shadows, Ra's al Ghul, when he said, "You haven't beaten me. You've sacrificed your footing for a killing stroke." Just before Mustaine fell into a frozen lake, leaving him, well, trapped under ice. Okay, I'm sorry. It just worked for the metaphor.
Coffee break, bouncing here and there and everywhere. High adventures that's beyond compare. It is a coffee break.
Evidence B.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you got love that I call sex. But you've been kissing when you ought to be screwed.
Dave Mustaine loves covers, and for some reason he insisted on putting them on Megadeth's records. Now, I don't mind a cool cover, but, and maybe this is just me, I don't want to hear it on your album. I bought a Megadeth album, not a Nancy Sinatra or a Lee Hazelwood album. Play it in concert, or put it on a compilation, but 1983 is a little late to be putting cover songs on a debut. And you can argue that this has nothing to do with Metallica, but some of the lyrical license Mustaine takes sort of suggests otherwise. You've been kissing when you ought to be screwing, and now someone else can kiss your ass. The lady doth protest too much, methinks. Lyrics which Mustaine changed in 2002 after Lee Hazelwood, the song's original writer, objected to so many people in their 20s learning who he was. I called these boots Motorhead inspired because the cover feels very punky, and nothing says punk metal like Motorhead. And the lyrics work as a punk song, but again, the whole thing feels like anathema to the fundamental shift that Black Sabbath made in the 70s away from the pedestrian and intrapersonal scale of popular music. These two songs, Mechanics and These Boots, sound like heavy metal. But to me, the lyrical and thematic content are on a scale that is just too small to match their sound. When it comes down to it, whatever it is, I think this is why I have always liked and appreciated Megadeth, but never truly loved them. I have loved songs, and after this latest deep dive, I have definitely come to love albums, which we'll talk about on the next episode. But throughout Megadeth's discography, I kept coming face to face with songs like Mechanics and These Boots, Liar, a couple albums later, that feel like they undermine the larger musical project that is Megadeth by injecting small, personal, and frankly really petty offerings that run counter to what I think is one of the most important features of heavy metal, and that is its scale. Megadeth is great because of Dave Mustaine and his quest for vengeance. And when the band falls short of that greatness, as we will see them do with greater regularity in a couple of episodes, I think it's because Megadeth becomes less important to Dave Mustaine than Dave Mustaine does. Metal isn't small. Megadeth isn't small. But sometimes, Dave Mustaine is. And when I struggle with Megadeth, it's because Mustaine has taken the epic, sprawling, historical vision of Megadeth and the unquestionable genius of his musicianship and reduced it to making fun of Chris Poland's girlfriend. On the Metallica episodes, I gently suggested that their rise and fall were both a result of their ambition. For Megadeth, I would like to gently suggest that their rise and the slow, steady deterioration toward their final form might also be born of the same parent. Not ambition, but rather vengeance. Metallica's sense of outrage died the minute they could afford not to have one, but Dave Mustaine, despite the effluence of contradictory and post-facto retconning he has done on the topic of his motivations and behavior throughout the years, has never ceased to see himself as an aggrieved figure. The world, and many of us in it, have wronged Dave Mustaine. First Metallica, then Cold War-era reconstruction of international political power balancing tenuously on the powder keg of mutually assured destruction. Then Metallica again, Barack Obama for some reason, then Monsanto, cloth masks, Obama again, and probably another Metallica somewhere in there. Dave's a weird guy. He's a fucking brilliant guy, and we have so much to thank him for. But he's a weird guy. But for those incredible moments, or songs, or even entire albums in which Dave can channel his anger into our anger, filter his sense of anxiety, outrage, and his desperate need for vengeance through the prism of the universal consciousness of we Vicks that have endured a monstrous and tortured history at the hands of the totalitarian impulses inherent in the human heart, there is just no one better.
Nobody does it better
than Dave Mustaine. Sometimes I wonder where Dave got that flyer from. The one containing the word Megadeth before he got on that Greyhound bus. Why was he still holding on to it? I tend to keep things like that to use as bookmarks. And I can't help but think, what if Dave Mustaine was using the paper handout containing the DNA of his future to remind him of where he left off in his book? And of course, being a writer and a cheesy romantic, also possessed of an insatiable hunger for dramatic irony so bleak that they would make Francisco Goya wince, I thought, what if the book was Moby Dick? Of course, Mustaine would undoubtedly have crossed out Moby and written in Lars is a total in its place. But I continued my little ham-fisted indie film cold open that when Dave sat down for the very long, very existentially wrought trip back to San Francisco, what if he opened up Herman Melville's 1851 wailing epic about one man's solipsistic obsession with exacting revenge on the white whale that took his leg, and instead of diving right back into that ponderous American classic, he instead became curious about his makeshift bookmark? And of course, the rest is history. But in the shitty, straight-to-DVD pitch meeting I've currently trapped you in, Mustaine never picks that book up again. He leaves it open on the seat next to him, abandoning it entirely upon changing vehicles for a subsequent leg of the trip. Mustaine returns to California, Megadeth flyer with the raw material of future song lyrics scribbled on the back, clenched in a white-knuckled fist. Upon taking the future frontman's former seat, some random Greyhound patron picks up the discarded copy of Moby Dick and peruses the passage that Dave Mustaine would never read. And it is this. The white whale swam before him as the monomaniac incarnation of all those malicious agencies which some deep men feel eating at them. That intangible malignity which has been from the beginning. Ahab did not fall down and worship it, but deliriously transferred its idea to the abhorred white whale. He pitted himself, all mutilated, against it. All that most maddens and torments, all that stirs up the dust of things, all truth with malice in it, all that cracks the sinews and coats the brain, all the subtle demonisms of life and thought, all evil, to Ahab were visibly personified and made practically assailable in Moby Dick. He piled upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the rage and hate felt by his whole race. If his chest had been a cannon, he would have shot his heart upon it.
Making my way downtown, walking fast, faces pass and I'm homebound.
Okay, that was a weird music choice for the opening credits to the film, but I think with a limited release and getting Eddie Redmayne on board to play Mustaine, we could come close to making our money back. Don't answer me now. Just think about it for next time. Oh, speaking of next time, on the next and volume So What, I get to talk about so many moments of brilliance yet to come in the discography of Megadeth. Also the stupid petty shit, but I'll try to make it funny. Oh, crap. I should probably let the So Pod boys out of that closet. Hey, Greg? Greggers? Gregadeth? Greg Wet Omelet? Hey, buddy? How you guys doing in there?
Pretty rad.
Pretty rad. Okay. Is Jonathan still in there with you?
Oh, no.
You don't know. It's not that big a closet, Greg.
Die bag.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to have to edit that out. Okay, Greg, I'm going to wrap up here, but then I'll let you guys out, okay?
Actually, don't worry about it. The acoustics in here are incredible. Greg and I have recorded like 4 songs.
You've recorded 4 songs in there?
Yes, we're thinking of doing an album.
Oh, wow, that's cool. So what are you going to call it? Hangers 18? Sashes in your mouth? The chic, the dying, and the dead sexy? Ugh.
Why do you say that?
All right, good luck, guys. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Well, we got lucky, fellow punchers of mother. Because on the next and volume So What, we get to talk about what I think is one of the greatest heavy metal records of all time. Maybe even 2 of them. And I promise it won't be And Justice for All. It will, however, be a Megadeth record. Which one or ones, you don't ask?
Fuck around and find out!
Yeah, fuck around and find out!
Fuck around, find out!